The clerk will call the next case. G. Nelson Mackey Jr. against Harriet Dodson McDonald, Executrix, etc. et al. Timothy E. Kirtner for the appellant. James J. O'Keefe the fourth. Anthony M. Segura, Arthur P. Strickland, Matt J. O'Heron for the appellees. Mr. Kirtner, are you able to hear me?
I am.
And Mr. O'Keefe, are you able to hear me?
I am.
Chief Justice Lemons, the attorneys are ready. Are you able to hear me and counsel?
I am.
Justice Goodwin, are you able to hear myself and counsel?
Yes.
Justice Mims, are you able to hear myself and counsel?
Yes.
Justice Powell, are you able to hear myself and counsel?
Yes.
Justice Kelsey, are you able to hear myself and counsel?
Yes.
Justice McCullough, are you able to hear me and counsel?
Yes.
Justice Chaffin, are you able to hear me and counsel?
Yes.
Mr. Chief Justice, the attorneys are now prepared to argue.
All right. Mr. Kirtner, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. And first, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, if I may.
All right.
May it please the court, Your Honors, my name is Tim Kirtner, and I represent the appellant G. Nelson Mackey Jr. on this appeal from the final order entered by the Roanoke City Circuit Court on February 25, 2019. Your Honors, the appellee's conversion actions, which were the only causes of action they tried, were time barred. Statute of limitations for conversion case is 5 years. That these actions were filed more than 5 years after those causes of action allegedly accrued is not in dispute at all. Mr. Mackey received the proceeds of the stock and cash in September of 2009. Suit was not filed until December of 2015. And these actions survive today only because the trial court embraced a novel and unintended interpretation of the tolling provision of Section 8.01-229D of the Code of Virginia. That statute reads, in relevant part, that when the filing of an action is obstructed by defendants using any other direct or indirect means to obstruct the filing of an action, then the time that such obstruction has continued shall not be counted as any part of the period within which the action must be brought. The trial court concluded that a passing statement of opinion allegedly made by Mr. Mackey in January of 2004, 5 years before the cause of action accrued, and 5 years before Mackey had done anything that allegedly gave rise to a cause of action, somehow told the statute of limitations for that cause of action that would accrue 5 years later based upon an act committed 5 years later. And quite frankly, Your Honors, when you say it out loud, it almost illustrates the problem. Just by itself.
What is the statement of opinion that you were referring to?
Well, the statement of opinion is as to the relative value of the cost of doing the appeal, the bond for the lost stock certificate as compared with the actual value of the stock. That was the statement that was allegedly made in January of 2004. And it didn't express a specific amount of value for the stock. So when I characterize that as a statement of opinion, it really was a statement of opinion as to the relative cost of doing the lost stock certificate or the bond for the lost stock certificate as compared with the value, actual value of the stock. So, Your Honors,
this is Justice Mims. At the time, wasn't that statement, though, essentially forward-looking? He was intending that anyone considering the value of the stock would rely upon that statement into the future, was he not?
Well, Your Honor, that is certainly a factual question. It's difficult for me to get to on appeal. We know what the trial court concluded, but the real question, I think, Your Honor, is whether there was any misrepresentation at all.
Was the trial court's conclusion a finding of fact?
I think that the trial court's finding as to Mackey's intent is a finding of fact. Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that. But going back a little bit further upstream, Your Honor, it doesn't matter. The question of intent doesn't matter at all if there's no misrepresentation. And what we are saying, Your Honor, is that factually there was no misrepresentation because Mr. Mackey, in an email 3 months before this alleged, actually 2 months before this alleged statement, told Mr. Quinn precisely the number of shares of stock that were owned by this partnership. Mr. Quinn was a sophisticated person, graduated from fine law school, had been in practice, private practice for a number of years, ultimately worked for Norfolk Southern. And he acknowledged it would have been really easy for him to take that additional step of determining the precise value of that stock when he got that information. But he didn't do that. And I do
when a colleague in the bar makes a statement to me or to you, can we not expect to rely upon it? Should we depend upon a presumption that every attorney who makes a statement to us is lying?
No, certainly not, Your Honor. But what I am saying is that the statement that was made in 2004, in January 2004, has to be informed by what was said 2 months earlier. I mean, you can't uncouple those two things. Let's just put out this potential hypothetical, Your Honor. What if Mr. Mackey had told Mr. Quinn exactly the value of the stock in October 20, 2003? I suspect we all could agree that we can't call the statement in January a misrepresentation of that circumstance. Take it an incremental step further. What if he had told him the number of shares of stock and the share value, but not done the calculation? Still, he's clearly told him the value of the stock. And then this is just a tiny incremental step further, that he's told him the number of shares of stock. And so, no, Your Honor, I agree. We should be able to rely on what counsel tells us. But you can't uncouple the statement in, or the alleged statement, I should say, in January of 2004 from the fact that he essentially told him the value of the stock. And then moving on from that, Your Honor, it's important to remember whose cause of action this is. This cause of action was not Quinn's. This cause of action was Ms. Byers. And I'm using cause of action, and later on in our assignment, I certainly take the position there's no cause of action because they didn't have a possessory interest. But for the moment, this cause of action was Ms. Byers' cause of action. And why didn't she act on this? She didn't act on it not because of anything Mr. Mackey did. She didn't act on it because Mr. Quinn never told her what Mr. Mackey had told him. And that's a critical piece of this as well. What was it that prevented Ms. Byers from investigating further and perhaps redeeming the stock herself or taking some action in that regard? It was that she had no idea how much stock there was. That wasn't Mr. Mackey's fault. That was Mr. Quinn's fault. And so that point too, Your Honor, I think gets to some of the larger sort of academic and theoretical problems with applying this statute as the trial judge did. Because if you follow that factual analysis any further, what you come to is that if Ms. Byers, who said she would have investigated further if she knew how many shares of stock there were, had known, it wouldn't have prevented her from bringing a cause of action because there was no cause of action. There would have been no cause of action at all. That's how far upstream we are and how far upstream the trial court was from what is intended by Section 8.01229D. That statute talks about obstructing something essentially that has already happened. There would have been no cause of action here at all had Mr. Quinn communicated to his client what Mr. Mackey told him. And so that's important factually, but it also illustrates some of the problems with the analysis that the trial court engaged in. Now, that's assignment number two, Your Honor. And I think that's the narrowest basis or grounds for reversing. And there's a full menu of bases here for reversing. what the trial court did in rendering judgment for Mr. Mackey. Well, let's talk briefly about assignment number one. We were talking a little bit earlier about intent, and that's a good segue back to assignment of error number one, because you can't have the intent to obstruct the filing of a cause of action that does not exist and based upon a wrong you haven't committed yet. It just doesn't make sense. And, Your Honor, it does bring us to a discussion of the Hicks versus director of the Department of Corrections case. At most, Your Honor, Hicks stands for the proposition that where the act of obstruction and a wrongful act giving rise to the cause of action occur simultaneously, the tolling provision can be applied even though there is no cause of action to toll at that time. That's the most we can read into Hicks, and I'll come back to Hicks if I have time. Why is that important? First of all, because no court has gone the further step of saying that where a defendant has not even committed a wrongful act that will give rise to a cause of action, that something he does at that stage can be used to trigger tolling under Section 8.01-229D. And what you do prior to the commission of a wrongful act, and I am not in any way, shape, or form acknowledging or admitting any wrongful act on behalf of Mr. Mackey, but talking about this in the larger perspective, what you do prior to committing a wrongful act, or sometimes simultaneously, like in the case of Grimes versus Suzukawa, is not intended to obstruct the filing of a cause of action for something you haven't done. It's to facilitate the wrongful act that you may ultimately commit. And that's a different thing, conceptually, from an action that is taken to obstruct the filing of a cause of action after you've done something and after a cause of action has already accrued. And 801-229D is intended to address that latter situation. And Your Honors, I want to dive into the statute just a little bit, too. You know, we pointed out in our brief that if you look at 801-229, there are multiple...
You have 5 minutes remaining. I just thought I'd remind you, you can use it any way you'd like.
I will hold on to that 5 minutes and yield the virtual floor to Mr. O'Keefe.
Well, excuse me, you have 3 minutes and 45 seconds remaining. You're beyond 5 minutes, but...
Even more the reason to reserve it. Thank you.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Jay O'Keefe, and I represent the Appalese. And I'd like to take a step back now and just recalibrate. Your Honors, we find ourselves here after a bench trial in which an experienced circuit judge found that Mr. Mackey, a Virginia lawyer with more than 40 years' experience, had maliciously converted stock and cash belonging to the estates of his former law partners. As Justice Mims noted, he made a finding of fact about Mackey's intent based on a mountain of evidence, including the point that Mackey falsely told the executor of one of the estates that the stock was worthless. He never told the other two estates about the stock or cash at all. But he did contact the stock's issuer, claiming to be a representative of the long-defunct law firm. He drew up new firm letterhead, especially for the occasion, adding his name and listing his home address as the firm's office. He directed the issuer to liquidate the stock and send him the proceeds, which he proceeded to deposit in the bank account of a separate company he controlled and never mentioned again. Mackey now insists that the claims against him are time-barred. He faults the circuit court for holding that his intentional misrepresentation told the statute of limitations under Code Section 801-229D because it came before he took the stock, not after it. But he doesn't point to anything in the statute's text or the ample case law applying it to support that reading. And though he demands de novo review on various points, he's really launching a broadside against the circuit court's fact findings. His efforts to relitigate each of them fail. And I'll start out in the beginning with 801-229. Now, as the court knows, the application of a tolling statute presents a mixed question of fact or law, and we're going to show deference to the trial court's fact findings on the relevant points. So that's the first hurdle that Mackey hits out of the gate. And the second one is that 229D is a remedial statute, so it has to be liberally construed. The statute itself, as my friend Mr. Kirtner pointed out, is incredibly broadly worded, applying when a defendant uses any direct or indirect means to obstruct the filing of an action. Nothing in its text says or even suggests that a cause of action has to accrue before a defendant could obstruct its filing, and it's certainly not our job to add to or amend clear statutory language. In fact, Mackey himself concedes at page 12 of his brief that under 801.229d1, a cause of action can be obstructed before it accrues. As a matter of textual interpretation, that concession is going to doom his position because there's nothing different about the language of 229d2 that we're here to talk about today. The nub of the argument comes down to whether or not you can intend to obstruct the filing of a cause of action that hasn't accrued yet. Again, we're here to talk about conversion, which is an intentional tort. In the context of an intentional tort, of course you can plan to obstruct the filing of an intentional tort you haven't committed yet because the tort's intentional. You're doing it on purpose. An intentional tort can be planned, and any remotely sophisticated bad actor is going to take steps in advance to cover his tracks. The examples we listed in our brief, a burglar's going to plan an alibi, a bank robber is going to line up a getaway car, and an embezzler is going to make sure that he has a way to keep the crime from his partners. The case law interpreting the statute explains that tolling is triggered by a few elements: an affirmative misrepresentation that involves moral turpitude, which defers or debars the plaintiff from her action. All those elements are met here. Mackey lied to Quinn about the value of the stock. That's not a statement of opinion. That's a statement about the value of the stock. It's an affirmative misrepresentation. It involved moral turpitude because Nelson Mackey was a lawyer with 40 years experience talking to the representative of his former law partner's widow. It deterred the plaintiff, it deterred her from filing her cause of action. And after he made the statement, he took possession of the stock himself and deposited it in the account of a separate company. What's more, and this is where our argument gets into a bit of a stretch, but Hicks and Evans teach that staying silent when you have a duty to speak can also count as obstruction, and Mackey had a duty to advise the executors of the stock's value. Under Code Section 50-73.101, he was a partner. If he was a partner, he had a duty to furnish that information to the legal representatives of his deceased partners without demand. And on top of that,
Justice, he was Kelsey, Virginia. Let me interrupt you for a second. The typical conventional view is that silence is never going to be enough for obstruction. And there may be other ethical duties, there may be partnership duties, but silence on its own is never enough. Is my right that your basic way around that is to attribute the duty to speak in this obstruction context to the partnership relationship?
Two points there, Your Honor. First, we do have the affirmative misrepresentation about the value of the stock. So his statement that the stock
didn't rely upon that. Two of the estates did not rely upon that affirmative statement. Am I right about that? Is there any evidence that all three estates relied upon that?
There's evidence that the estate that was in communication with him through Quinn and Beyer did rely on it, and they did not talk to the other estates based on that case that we heard about earlier. The defendant did not make a direct statement to the plaintiff, but Eastern District of Virginia found that the was nonetheless sufficient to toll the statute of limitation as to those plaintiffs. Apart from that, our argument is that there's an affirmative partnership duty and an affirmative ethical duty under 4C, not to engage involving dishonesty, fraud, presentation adversely on a lawyer's fitness to practice, that would trigger an obligation on Mackey's part to alert the other part in the estates of the stock. And really, I don't think there's a way to make sense Hicks and Evans without understanding those two cases, and especially Hicks, to some limited circumstances where there's an affirmative duty to speak, a failure to speak that amounts to concealment can trigger obstruction. And I think that's consonant with the general principle that in a fraud cause of action, concealment can count as an affirmative misrepresentation. And I think that lines up here, and I think that's what would support the obstruction. Assignment of error two, Your Honors, as Justice Mims points out, challenges what's basically a fact finding about support of misrepresentation. The trial court lists the evidence that it considered at page 53 of the joint appendix, and it's not worth going through all that evidence now. Mackey says all that evidence is trumped by the fact that he mentioned the number of shares in an email in October 2003 to Quinn. First of all, the trial court as a fact finder is well within its rights to consider the mountain of contrary evidence and the one email, weigh them, and decide that the more persuasive as to Mackey's mental state. On top of that, it's fully possible for the fact finder to have concluded that this this email that Mackey sent, which followed a conversation he had with Mike Quinn on the street, was essentially an oversight, that he didn't think through all the implications of what he was doing. That would be consistent with the evidence before the trial court. Another conclusion the fact finder could have reached, which would have been consistent with for it, is that when Mackey sent that email in October 2003, his plan, and when he made the notation about the value of the stock 3 months later, he had a different plan, and that his intent changed in the meantime. That's also consistent with the evidence.
Again, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can I go back to the two estates that did not have the affirmative representation directly told to them? If the duty of one partner to another partner in a partnership is requires them to say something about their own tort, wouldn't that mean that if one partner converts partnership assets from another partner, the statute of limitation would never run unless the tortfeasor partner fessed up?
I think the specific duty that we're relying on, Your Honor, is under 7101, the duty to provide certain information partnership assets to representatives of the state. And so to address your
partner steals the partnership assets from the other partner, and the tortfeasing partner has a duty to notify, can't be silent, does that mean that that being obstruction results in a statute of limitations never ever running on that one tort?
So the if the failure to meet the statutory obligation to inform your decedent partner's estate of the value of a partnership asset obstructs the running of the statute of limitations, and the statute can never run. The statute can never run as long as you haven't informed the representatives of the deceased partner's estates. And so if you have one or two or three decedents, I don't know. I haven't thought through the rest of the hypothetical, Your Honor, but I don't think that would be completely unwieldy. If the estates have been cashed out, I think their claims to the stock lay. I mean, they're no longer partnership assets, and I think that's typically what would happen in the case of a decedent partner.
Yeah, I'm only just trying to follow the logic of it all, because if you're relying upon a fiduciary duty that's been codified, and I understand it, but if it were true that silence triggers obstruction and the fraud-feasing partner has a fiduciary duty to confess to his fraud-feasing, and the absence of that is obstruction, I think logically that means the statute of limitations of fraud never applies in that context. I think that's what you're saying. If you're not, please correct me.
I think our argument is limited to the specific statutory duty to notify the representative of the decedent's estate. It's because there's a specific duty outlined in the statute to do that, and he didn't meet it. And so I think until all those estates are notified, the statute is going to be told as to the estate. Not Uniform Partnership Act, the original Uniform Partnership Act and the revised Uniform Partnership Act. And in the trial court and even in his petition for appeal, Mackey argued the revised Uniform Partnership Act, but that act didn't take effect until 2000, after the stock had been issued. And so to the extent that Mackey argued both in his petition for appeal and in the trial court that under the revised Uniform Partnership Act, stock issued in the name of the old partnership was presumptively an asset of the old partnership, that argument's wrong because the statute doesn't apply, as even he now concedes. And so since he didn't raise the argument that he's making on appeal, the argument under the Uniform Partnership Act, either below or in his petition for appeal, that argument's waived. Separate and apart from the forfeiture, the argument fails on its face because the Uniform Partnership Act it contemplates that the withdrawal of one partner from a partnership is going to cause the dissolution of that partnership. And if the partnership continues, it does so as a new partnership. And in our brief, we pointed out the Virginia CLE treatise and a corporate finance textbook that explain how that worked, along with a few citations to the old Uniform Partnership Act. But after dissolution, the remaining partners have the option of either carrying on the business as a new partnership or winding it up and terminating it. In Code Section 50-38 and 50-41 in the old Uniform Partnership Act, in particular, pretty clearly contemplate the situation where after a withdrawal, the remaining partners continue along as a new partnership. So here the trial court was right. Mackey's withdrawal triggered the dissolution of the old partnership in 95, and Dodson Pence Vier continued as a new partnership. It even filed a new certificate of partnership. Mackey was never a partner in that entity, and that's the entity that had a relationship when Trigon issued the stock. So for those reasons, Your Honors, and the reasons that we explained in our brief, we'd ask the court to affirm the circuit court's judgment.
All right. Mr. Kirtner, you have 3 minutes and 45 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. And let me say before I forget to say it that we're going to rely on our brief or briefs for assignments of error number 4 and 5. I'm not going to address those. I think it's already been mentioned by one of the justices. I don't recall who asked this question precisely. I think Justice Mims has pointed out that the alleged misrepresentation was never communicated to McDaniel and Nurse and Urso or their predecessors. And the quick and dirty of that is there has to be intent. And if Mr. Mackey had no idea that his statement was ever going to be published to their predecessors, he could not have had any intent to obstruct those predecessors in the filing of any cause of action that may accrue, setting aside whether it can be even applied here. I think, Your Honor, one other thing that's kind of important to look at, too, is this whole question of silent or duty really hinges on whether the court will view Hicks as having any application beyond its very specific holding. And I think in that case, this court took great care to tell us all, don't try to use this on anything else. That's the way I read the court's holding. I won't tell the court what it said, but I think that's the holding. I don't think that there's anything to be extrapolated from Hicks about duties or any of those sorts of things or potential duties triggering the statute or the statutory tolling. But I'll just finish with this. As Justice Kelsey has pointed out, the problem with this application of the tolling provision is it abrogates statutes of limitations in their entirety, as it certainly relates to conversion. As Justice Kelsey has aptly pointed out, it turns the tolling provision into a discovery rule. That's what it effectively does. This application does that. And the Virginia General Assembly has demonstrated to us that they know how to craft a discovery rule because they've done it. And they did it, most importantly for this case, in the case of a cause of action for fraud. And so they created a discovery rule. They made it an accrual statute. That is to say, there's a deferred accrual of the cause of action as opposed to tolling. And that's really relevant here because that's the action the plaintiffs wanted to and needed to try. And they didn't try it, in my humble opinion, because they knew they couldn't meet the due diligence requirement necessary to avail themselves of that discovery rule. Could there have been a cause of action based upon an ongoing course of conduct, which is really what we're talking about, and that's what they're trying to talk about? Sure, there could be fraud in an ongoing conduct, but that's not the cause of action that was tried. The cause of action that was tried was a conversion action, and that conversion action and the act that gave rise allegedly to that conversion action did not happen until 5 years after this alleged misrepresentation. They tried the wrong cause of action, probably because they had to, and they attempted, with the court's help, to try to shoehorn the conversion case into 801-229D. That's why you have these really incongruent results that Justice Kelsey has pointed out. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time. If you don't have any further questions, I'll yield.
I have a question. You said that you want to rely on assignments of error 4 and 5. Did I hear that correctly?
That I do want to rely on our brief with respect to 4 and 5.
Okay, now I understand. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call the next case.